This is the RTE Rugby Podcast. Thanks for joining us this week as Leinster prepare to face Saracens for the title of Team of the Decade, which might be a little glib, but only a touch, because it's hard to argue with all the same. It's a tough match also to have a definite opinion on who's going to win. Leinster facing few teams as underdogs, and the odds compilers have it as a 50-50 game. Robert Kitson in The Guardian described trying to pick a winner as like plunging a hand into a sack of ravenous pythons and waiting to see which one grabs you first. A bit melodramatic, but maybe not. So today we're going to do a bit of snake wrestling about who will be crowned champions and team of the decade. Michael Glennon and Eddie O'Sullivan are in studio. We're going to be joined by Alex Spink from The Mirror a little bit later. Michael, talk us through other stories, though. There's been other bits and pieces of activity in the rugby world.
Indeed. Good afternoon, Dara. I suppose London Irish have been busy again. We learned yesterday, it was kind of an open secret, that Paddy Jackson would join up from the start of next season. And today they've announced that Wysacka Naholo will join. So he's a 26 cap All Black, 16 tries. Fantastic signing for them. It just shows their ambition for next year. They're desperate not to go down anyway and maybe to make even more of an impression. Yesterday we also heard that Munster coaches Felix Jones and Gerry Flannery declined new contracts, and it was kind of stressed in the press release that that was the situation. They were offered something and they didn't want to sign, so we may touch on that later on. And of course the rest of it is the build up to Saturday's game, but we'll just, the women's sevens are in Langford this weekend as well.
All right. OK, well, look, we will talk about reaction to Paddy Jackson signing and also the Felix Jones-Gerry Flannery saga. Unusual timing for that, with Munster still having something to play for. You'd think it indicates maybe not a happy situation down there, or at least it's certainly not news that you'd expect until post-season. And we'll get Eddie's thoughts on that as well. But
absolutely, yeah. We're going to hear from Saracens boss Mark McCall in a moment. But first up, Leinster coach Stuart Lancaster, who's talking to Michael Corcoran. And Michael started by asking him how much last year's run to the final will count for in Saturday's game.
They've been there as well. Yep. I mean, I was looking at their team that played against Clermont in the final in 2017, and pretty much the same pucks probably going to turn out this time if Vincent Cox starts. But both teams are chocked full of experience and of European Cup experience, and from our point of view, that's what makes it such a brilliant matchup. You know, we're really looking forward to the challenge. We played them last year, and we managed to get the win, but I think they've improved a lot since then, so we need to be at our best.
How much of this week will really be about Leinster and what you can do? I know you've got to pay the respect to Saracens and try and dissect their game as the week goes on as well, even from a planning point of view.
It's both, really. I mean, obviously, a lot of the planning was done last week as well. You know, we didn't have the game of the weekend, fortunately. We got top of our conference, which gives the weekend off. So, yeah, obviously, it goes from, you know, thoughts of Saracens and plans for Saracens to, actually, this is what Leinster can bring. And that happens sort of, there's a transitional period during the week, probably Thursday. And, you know, we back ourselves. You know, we're the champions at the moment. We've got the most tries in each of the pool stages in the last 3 years. We scored 95 tries in the league, so we'll back ourselves.
It's going to be a huge challenge, isn't it? I mean, you've mentioned Saracens, where they are certainly in the English Premiership, and their track record. I mean, it's two really, really good teams going head to head.
Yeah, I mean, it's the experience that they've got and the quality. You know, they play a pressure game really well. Their defence is excellent. They've got great attacking threats on starter plays. Owen Farrell and Alex Good are great ball players, so they've got threats in the unstructured part of the game. They've got a very tight and collective team spirit, and world-class players in most positions, if not all. So, it's a brilliant matchup. It's two best teams, and I guess it's the one that everyone wants to see.
And in terms of your squad, is Sean Cronin the person that you'd be kind of mostly concerned about?
Yeah. You know, we'll give him as long as we can. Obviously, there comes a point where you need to sort of make a call, but we'll give him as long as we can because he's such a key player and influential player for us. Josh van der Fleer coming back in the equation, probably not for this game, but for the semi-final against Munster, will be a big boost for the squad. James Gibson Park coming back, but no, we're not too bad at the moment. Obviously, you know, on the back of the Toulouse game, there's always nervousness that you've got to get through to this point, but we've still got a couple of train sessions to go, so we'll keep everyone, you know, wrapped in cotton wool, hopefully.
And the venue, I mean, that's one of the incredible things about this competition. It's bringing us to maybe venues that you normally wouldn't go to, certainly as a rugby fan. I mean, St. James's Park, one of the most iconic venues in terms of world sport, and I might say rugby as it will be this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from the north, obviously, so I think it's brilliant for the city. You know, it's a shame, obviously, the team has been relegated, Newcastle from the Premiership, and my own team in Yorkshire, they've struggled. So, you know, there's a big void at the moment for rugby union. And I think this is a brilliant way to fill it. And I know that the city of Newcastle is a brilliant city. So a lot of fans I found in Bilbao had just come across. They'd booked, irrespective of who's going to be in the final, they've come for the weekend, and I think they'll have a brilliant weekend. You know, they've got the great game Friday night against the two French teams, and obviously the final on Saturday. So it'll be a great weekend.
There's a huge hunger, drive and desire like within this group. Is it something that, I won't say surprises you, but do you just kind of stand back from time to time and go, you know, I like the way these fellas kind of drive themselves on basically to be better all the time?
No, they're a very humble group, a very hard working. Their desire to want to play well for Leinster is you know, it's stronger than any other team we've been involved in, because so many are from Leinster themselves, and they want to repay the support that the fans give them. And and you're right, you know, they achieved last year, but they want to achieve again and again and again. And that combination of experienced players who've been there and seen it and done it, and the young players who want to be there, makes it a very strong combination.
Do you get to enjoy a week like this? I mean, as a coach, you've mentioned nervousness. I mean, it must be there throughout the group. You know, again, even the sense of excitement and anticipation. But can you live in the moment and enjoy the build up to what is like the greatest game in European rugby this season?
I wouldn't say enjoyment's the word I would use, but no. I mean, as the week rolls on and you've done your work as a coach, you sort of try and sit back and relax and enjoy the experience and the build up to it. But no, there's a tension and there's a nervousness that's around everyone, because you want to perform well on the big stage, and you get to a point as a coach also where it actually falls out of your control. So I've learnt that feeling of helplessness is part of the deal, really. And then, you know, obviously the game takes place, and you know, you just want everyone to perform well. And you know that if we perform well and we play to our ability, we've got a chance of winning. And if we win, it'll be an amazing experience. And either way, win, lose, or draw, well, there won't be no draw. There's something coming around the corner called Munster in the Pro 14 semi-final to focus your mind on in about 7 days' time. So, you know, and so the show rolls on.
It must be almost like watching your child grow up and bringing them to school, and you stand at the school gate and let their hand go, and they walk off, and you're standing there like a helpless parent on the side of the road.
Yeah, it is a bit like that. But the difference is, when you've got an experienced team, is, you know, they're a bit older and they're a bit wiser, and they can usually navigate the challenges. But that's not to say, I mean, it's all very well saying, we plan to do this, but you've got another team trying to stop you do it. And they're very good at doing that. They're very good at all the component pieces of the game. You know, they're a fantastically well-coached team. They back it. They back themselves. But so do we. So, you know, they won the final 2 years in a row. We won it last year. So here we go.
Our own experience in finals and these big matches is that, you know, these games turn on small moments, and it might be a magical moment, it might be a switch off moment, and we just gotta be ready to take advantage of windows that open for us, which are gonna be few and far between in the game, and close the windows that we open up for them. So it's gonna be one of those games, I think, which will turn on something which seems small but turns out to be big.
Okay, that was Mark McCall finishing off. Back to Lancaster first. Michael, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way they're going to talk about the game. They're not going to give too much away. They're going to talk up the opposition, and you would expect nothing less from Lancaster. He's hammering home the point that they have been the best team easily over the last 2 years in Europe. And obviously they're coming up against a team who were previously the best team in Europe.
Yeah, I want to talk about Leinster and the transformation of Leinster, Eddie, from 2009, if we go back to the match in Croke Park where the whole pendulum swung. Leinster have done everything perfectly. That mightn't please everyone, but they've got very few things wrong, from player recruitment to managing, coach recruitment, marketing, the whole lot.
Yeah, they've done a lot of things right, but they're also in a very good position to do the things right. Leinster now are kind of a legacy team. They're a powerhouse in Europe. They're a team that are a club that everyone looks to from outside of Ireland, see how they do their business, which is, you know, you'd expect that. But there's a number of factors here which has fallen their way. So let's not take credit from them, but you're in a capital city, and you're the only professional rugby team in a large capital city. So you've got the effect of sponsorship there, over a million people. You have a great market.
Only professional, successful team in a European context in the city,
yeah,
really.
Absolutely, yeah. The bigger one is how did this, you know, treadmill of talent come through? And it's very simple. It goes back to the grassroots of basically schools rugby, the private schools in Leinster, having fantastic rugby programs over the years. And those players coming out now and being harvested into the professional game. In the old days, they play for their province and their club, and then they tried to play for Ireland, and that was the end of it. Professional game now, the academy structure is in place. They're identified early by the schools, they're identified early by the branches, the schoolboy team, the development teams, and the RFU identified them early. They go into academies, sub-academies. There's a whole pathway there. And the advantage Leinster have over Munster, Connacht and Ulster is just the volume, the number of schools. And some of these schools now, the programmes they're delivering they're mostly professional. I mean, literally, they're going to warm weather training camps, they're dietitians, video analysis.
Ex-Springbok coaches, you name it.
Their own gyms, they train in the morning before school. Their transition from schools rugby into academy rugby is seamless because they've been at it for 3 or 4 years. So that's not going to stop.
I mean, they're like the West Point type of approach, aren't they?
It's extraordinary, but to be fair, the schools have been doing this for years now, and they've upped their game as well, obviously. You know, 20 years ago, they didn't have dietitians or video analysts, but they have moved professionally with the times as well. So they're delivering a product at schoolboy level that is, you know, all but professional. And they just go in seamlessly into the game. And then there's the volume. Like Leinster have some, like they do the same in Munster, they do the same in Ulster, do the same in Connacht. But Leinster have the volume, the number of private schools that have very good rugby programs in Leinster is huge, and so the cream of the crop come through, and you only have to pick maybe a small percentage of them every year, and it's an ongoing thing. It's now like the NCAA in America, delivering these diamonds, not in the rough anymore, and they go straight into the professional game practically.
So if you were to isolate one factor, it would be that production line.
I think the production line is extraordinary. Now, Leinster have the advantage, as I said, of the capital city, you know, the sponsorship, their support's been great. It's been like they're the best supported team in the Pro 14, probably one of the best supported teams in Europe week on week. Now, what they have done right, okay, because they had this for a number of years and it didn't click, but once they won in 2009, there's a number of things they got right. They've got their coaching tickets right a lot of the time. There's been stability around it most of the time. Their overseas signings have been very influential. They've been smart overseas signings. If you think back to Rocky Elsom, if you think back to Brad Thorne, if you think back to Eisin Osseo, who's probably the most influential one, who left and came back, and now Fardy, like there's a string of guys there who have had huge impacts on and off the field. Munster had those similar ones, you know, with maybe Doug Howlett. But
he was the last of the breed, really.
He was, and good Jim Williams before that, you know. But look, they've got the other things they've done really well. You know, and they've got a good system, a structure in their academy. It's incredibly hard to get into Leinster Academy. In fact, they're overproducing, I think, because the number of guys trading the professional game outside of Leinster in other provinces, there's a lot of them. Like you see guys like Charlie Murphy realising Jeremy Ford was still going to go to Ulster. So they are kind of, they've built this dynasty of a production line at school, very well funded because of their position in the marketplace. And then making good business decisions about coaches and about bringing in overseas players. And you have to take your head off to them. They had a great opportunity to get it right, and they have got it right.
Good business decisions is an interesting phrase to me, because there seems to be no need to orientate Leinster in a corporate culture. They think that way. I'm not saying that this is a criticism, but in terms of their recruitment, in terms of their marketing, the messaging, they're very comfortable with that modern corporate ethos.
But even the simple decisions, which are not simple at the end of the day, of where they would play their rugby. There'd be also suggestions that they should go outside the city and build a greenfield site, knowing that really the market's in the town. People coming in from the suburbs to watch the game, they knew Donnybrook, they'd outgrow Donnybrook. And they went to a place which is famous for show jumping. And it's been a huge success. And I mean, it's not the more, it's going to become a very modern place, but for the last 10 years, they've been very successful there. But if you sat in the old standard of the RDS, it's the same as it was 50 years ago. So they've managed that whole engagement with the public. And they had a couple of trip ups. There was, in the early days, they felt that they were just identified by the city team. But they've reached out now into all the counties. They've identified Leinster is not just Dublin. and there's a more connection now with all the Leinster counties. There were a lot of people down in South Leinster supporting Munster years ago. I think that's probably done and dusted now.
Yeah,
people
in Kilkenny, we spoke about that.
You're an Offaly man.
I'm from Offaly, and I didn't feel any allegiance growing up. I used to refer to Leinster rugby as a cold house for cultures. We'd come up, we'd be slagged about the accents, we'd be told, go off, you know, go home.
Play GA,
boggers and all this. And now when I see Leinster who have been down in Edenderry training, they're coming out, the coaches are coming down, they're opening up the fitness centre.
And some of their most influential players as well have come out of the country, like Sean O'Brien, like Tullo. Born and bred, still taking many rugby sessions there on a Sunday morning. You know,
Tyke Furlong,
farming background, Wexford. You know, they're all rooted connections in the.
That's
in,
an
in
interesting
the,
one
in the
because
rural area.
I think maybe it's just my generation and older, but you love to be knitted back into something that was, I suppose, pre-digital as well. And Tyke Furlong, Sean O'Brien can represent that type
absolutely,
of Ireland,
yeah.
which we grew up in.
That's right.
And Munster always harvested that kind of with the likes of Quinney and other lads like that seemed to be
Michael
fellas.
All the way from Kerry, you know, like,
yes.
like there's that connection, there's that country connection in Munster. Maybe it's because it's right between the two cities and Kerry has always been part of it in Tipperary. But Leinster was always seen as a Dublin team.
Well,
and that's changed now, which is very good marketing. And they needed to work on it. As you say, Michael, it was... And initially, they were seen as a city team and nobody really identified with them from outside of the city. But that's changed now, really has changed.
And O'Brien was actually in the papers at the weekend saying that when he first came up, maybe people would say, where's Tullo? And there would be a bit of tone to it. And he said that was sorted out quickly enough. There was a few slaps thrown or, he started throwing his weight around and all of a sudden he became one of the gang. But that had to be overcome as recently as Sean O'Brien going up there initially into the academy.
Well, it's just a fact of life that people from South County Dublin think they don't have an accent. So that tells you all you need to know. They think that's the actual normal way of speaking.
We'll leave it at that.
No, we won't. But I mean, if you're going to look at the recruitment then of supporters, and we'll go back to the game now in a minute. But like from 2009, we did the club match there at the weekend. There is no really engagement, no way of engaging with the club unless your dad or yourself or your brother or your son or your daughter start playing. Yeah. You don't really have that. So you're there floating around.
The engagement now at the clubs is in the mini rugby section and people, you know, kids, they bring kids to mini rugby, which is very important. And all the clubs have fantastic underage structures. But it's a different connection. It's not like that your dad played and your son played. They're still there, but there's not many of them. But it goes back to the fact that the vast majority of people going to see the provinces play on the weekend don't have a club attachment. Their club is Leinster, or their club is Munster, or their club is Connacht. And they don't go to see Old Belvedere play or St Mary's play or whatever, or Black Rock. That's not where you find them. And maybe they send their kids there for mini rugby, but they probably don't see the club playing at senior level. They go to the RDS to see Leinster. So there's nothing wrong with that. It's really important that demographic did change, that people identified with the game, which, again, there was that cultural switch in Irish rugby in the noughties. I was in the middle of it. I kind of noticed that the things that struck me was, I remember I tell the story, being in Tesco's in Galway shopping, when I was the Irish coach, keeping my head down, and I was behind two older ladies in front of me and they were blocking the aisle, but I kind of strolled along and I heard them talking and they said, I wonder will he pick Roger or Holmes next weekend? And like two elderly women who wouldn't be rugby tradition, Galway's not a huge rugby town. And I said, gee, why would they talk about rugby? Rugby was getting that traction in the market. There was more of it, there was a Six Nations, the Heineken Cup was at its peak. Still is, I suppose. You had Super Rugby, Tri-Nation stuff. Another one, you know, you'd see was people walking around in, you know, the Wellington Hurricanes rugby shorts. They'd never been to Wellington. Never seen a Hurricane either, probably. But, you know, that identity with the game, rugby jerseys became a fashion item. Not the prettiest sometimes for some people, you know.
But sure, some of them were appalling.
Since they were in the slim fit ones. But again, that all those small things to me were kind of little tipping points along the way that rugby was more in the psyche of the Irish public. People who hadn't watched rugby started watching rugby. They didn't go to rugby games either. And a percentage of those then started going to rugby games because they identified with Munster or Leinster. So that's been a cultural shift and Leinster have benefited from it by their own hard graft and the fact that they are they're in the key area for that, the big population. That's a big help as well.
And they've made so few mistakes. I mean, if you look at the big level recruitment now, whatever went on in the background when Leo Cullen was kind of wobbling a little at the start, Lancaster was brought in. Lancaster was dumped unceremoniously after 2015. And, I mean, everybody emphasises his appointment as a message more than anything else. We know that he's had a positive impact there. He's just bought a house, I think, in Ireland. He plans to stay here. He keeps his head down. He's a perfect ambassador. And my point is that Leinster may have a reputation for being the city club and being kind of big on the messaging and marketing, but they also play it low key. You don't see them going out blowing their trumpet. No, some of their supporters do, but we all do that when
but
our team's going
to,
well.
You know, they do their talking on the field. Look at their record, you know, the Heineken Cup successes, the Pro 14 successes. That's the best way to do your talking. You don't want to promote yourself if you do that. Mm. I think the Lancaster decision was a very, very shrewd decision. Tough decision for Leo Cullen, and you have to give huge respect to him for that, because a young coach finding his way and a more senior coach coming in under him, he can often feel that his own position has been diluted a little bit, and he didn't. He went with it. He got a good guy in Lancaster, to be fair. Lancaster has bedded in, not a high-profile guy, and has brought a stability to coaching setup. Very experienced Lancaster, you know, coached in England.
And stays out of the media too.
Yeah, he knows his way around the media, but he doesn't court it. Mm. And I just think that was a very smart signing, you know, and I know that I was sad to see Gervin Dempsey leaving, going to Bath, but maybe he wanted to go and get experience overseas. It's not a bad thing to do. But Constant Pomey's come in now. He's former Leinster as well. He knows his way around that neck of the woods. So that seems to have worked very well for him. So they've met some smart players as well. They've taken advantage of their advantages, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's what you're there for.
Mm-hmm. And then you look at what's happening in Munster, and okay, this might give Leinster supporters the itch if they just want to hear about the match on Saturday. Don't worry, we'll get to it. But, you know, Felix Jones and Gerry Flannery going, not unconnected, before a semi-final game against Leinster, which is not a particularly attractive vista on form from a Munster point of view. What's the timing puzzles me.
I think I can't get my head around it, how if this was going to happen, and obviously it was going to happen, why this couldn't have been kept under wraps for another couple of weeks until the season was over. I just don't get it. But I think Johan van Grant precipitated that a little bit a couple of weeks ago by just mentioning that he was thinking of bringing in an attack coach, which to me was a bizarre statement to make at this time of the season.
That made it tricky for Felix Jones. But
well, he must have felt a cold shiver down his spine when he heard that.
Gerry Flannery's unfireable, though, surely.
Well, Gerry Flannery was the big surprise, that the Munster pack has been, you know, firing pretty well all around, you know. And the other side of it is that I was disappointed that by throwing that out and kind of throwing Felix Jones under the bus, to the extent that, like, Van Grand said, well, it's all his problem, like, I just need to get another attack coach and everything will be fine. Like, that to me, as a head coach, you know, you have to stand over the performances. You can't delegate responsibility to other people when it's not going well. You've got to stand over it. And that getting into the ether, and then one of the players broke ranks, Chris Farrell, said, oh, the attack part of our game just last week before they played Benetton is the one missing piece of the jigsaw. A pretty large piece of the jigsaw, actually, you know, to be honest. But that destabilised the whole environment. And for some reason, they felt it wouldn't hold and it cracked this week. But it's terrible timing, because the two lads, whatever about what you think of them as coaches and, you know, people have different views, how are they going to work the next couple of weeks with the players knowing that they're halfway out the door? That's not easy. And it must be very awkward for them. And again, you know, it's potentially two young Irish coaches slipping out of the system. Not ideal for the RFU either.
And London Irish is recruiting all around them. Any future for those two coaches over there? I mean, this rumour is,
well,
around.
Like, of course, and Gervin Dempsey's in Bath, so it's not a million miles to the lads to slip over to England if they can get in somewhere. But it's probably, there's two sides to that sword, is that it's good for them to go away and get experience if they want to. But having said that, and the fact that they're leaving Munster, where they grew up and they played most of their rugby, that's, they need to get out of that bubble as well, maybe. But having said that, they're not exiting the bubble in the best possible way, is what I put it.
Destabilising is a fair enough one.
Yeah, well, what about the match on Saturday? Munster, from their body language, well, from the way they played, it almost seemed as if they didn't want to be there. I mean, they're probably still smarting from the Benetton game this weekend.
It was hard to
watch. They had a dead rubber after the Saracens game and they didn't seem to be pumped up. They should have been beaten, really, and they would have been beaten, but for a call at the end by the ref.
Yeah, it was just a pretty abysmal performance by any stretch. And, you know, you can dice it any way you want and say we want to get a win and we got a win. Like, they're playing a team like Munster, have aspirations. You know, they've published aspirations of being the best rugby team in the world, but they have aspirations of being big players in Europe. And then to get a spanking, really, you know, to show they're not a semi-final team, they're a quarter-final team, fair enough, everyone's on a journey. But they're playing a team last weekend that's basically a team that was happy to be in the playoffs, had just broken the glass ceiling. Mm. And there's no reason Munster should have had any problems struggling with them. They should have put them to bed very early. Mm. But I think there was, if you look back the week after the defeat to Saracens, which was tough, but, you know, you can't complain, the Saracens are who they are. The game, the next game that really, that they needed to look like they were going to respond to it, it was a Connacht game down in Thomond Park, and it was a very poor performance again. They were well loaded up to make sure they got to the playoffs, and they just underperformed again. And you can see this, I suppose, everything's weighing heavy on them at the moment. Mm. Everything's a load to carry. Mm. And they don't look like a team that are comfortable in their skin, and a lot of heavy sighs and eye rolling going on down there. And like, this is, the lads leaving now doesn't add anything to that. So Munster are not in a good place. And you can say it all goes back to their attack, and we can dissect that ad nauseum, and it's not a good attack.
I disagree.
But you'd have to wonder, is there more? You know, is there more? Like, it's not just, if they play well in the morning and attack, does everything, all their problems evaporate? And it's hard to know.
Well, I think if you close your eyes, Eddie, and you envisage the ultimate Munster team in the contemporary, in 2019, like the noughties are gone now. Mm. It's Saracens. Now, it's hard. Forget about personalities and forget about nationalities. But like, it's that type of rugby, which is an absolutely flint-tough, monster, muscular pack with a ruthless out-half, very canny, very clever, a touch dirty here and there, but one that really scares the you-know-what out of opposition. Saracens are 2019 version of Munster 2006-2008.
Yeah. Well, that was the Irish pack with the Irish halfbacks, and they did hit the wall until their first
cup. But you know what I mean? In their mind's eye, as a Munster supporter, that's what they want to be.
They were, but they're not that anymore.
No.
So I think I've made the point that they have to do a bit of soul searching and figure out that they're not in any time soon going to deliver another pack of forwards like that, that can basically out-muscle teams of the calibre of Saracens and look and change the way they play. There's this Munster way of playing, and it's kind of getting a bit dated. Their run the brick wall isn't going to work anymore unless they can change their personnel very quickly, and it's not going to happen.
But was the Rob Penny experiment. Didn't
well, that's
come
what I was going
either.
To say. Yeah. Rob Penny was the one guy who tried to pivot them away from this, and he didn't last long. And no, maybe he made some mistakes himself. He was probably too honest and open about it. The dogs in the street were talking about the wide pattern in Limerick, so then you knew everybody was talking about it. But he probably as well tried to transition too quickly. So he didn't manage. But I think in principle, he saw what he was trying to do was actually the way Munster need to have to move now. And they do have to look at themselves. Like, unless they're going to produce the depth that they're not getting from their academies because they don't have the numbers in the schools, they're not producing their own athletes, that they may have to look at finding a different way to skin the cat. And there's lots of ways to skin the cat. Benetton skinned the cat differently last week and should have beaten them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Nick McCarthy is the only recruit for next season, and, you know, fine player and all as he is, it isn't sending as much of a statement.
Well, it's not a shiver down any team's spine that they're going to be different. So I think they've got to recalibrate what they're at. They've got to look themselves. And part of that is the players as well, accepting that they may have to play a different type of rugby to get what they want to get. And it's not a bad rugby team. I think that's a decent Munster. It's a decent Munster pack.
Any chance against Leinster in a couple of weeks?
Well, there's always a chance in a derby. Mm. Like, we saw what Ulster did to Leinster in the quarter final. Mm. They came down, they rolled up their sleeves, they got stuck in. You know, derbies are about emotion, not rugby. Mm. And we saw the emotion of the game in Thomond Park for around Christmas. So that derby could be awful tricky for Leinster on paper, but derbies aren't played on paper.
Yeah, okay. Alex Spink, good day to you.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, it's good of you to come along and give us another perspective, because I know we're going to get slammed for talking about Leinster and then segueing into a good old 12-minute chat about Munster. Tell us about Saracens, because I don't understand the unpopularity kind of thing. I think it's overdone. I mean, they're basically just better than everyone else.
Yeah, it's the old Manchester United thing. It's what Liverpool are finding now at the moment, where some people talk them up and everyone else can't bear the fact that people are enjoying their success. It's the same with Saracens, and it's been that way for the last 5 or 6 years. You know, they are an incredibly accomplished team, as you've just been talking. I've been listening to your conversation with Eddie. They are a complete team in a club sense, certainly domestically. And over the last kind of 3 or 4 years in Europe, they just seem to go from strength to strength. They've been the team that just got out the pool stages and got cuffed in the quarterfinals. They learnt from that. They came back, reached semi-finals. Then they reached a final, lost to Toulon, learnt from that, came back again and won it twice. And now here we are at Newcastle on the weekend, and you know they really do look an irresistible force. That said, they're up against the old cliche, the old immovable object in Leinster. How they've been over recent years, you know, it really is a mouth-watering thought.
Yeah, and the continuity is there as well. I mean, what impresses me about Saracens, just in broad brushstrokes, is that they did have the wobble, and we've seen the likes of Northampton in the last decade, you know, threaten to break into the top echelon in a season or two, have a couple of bad defeats, most notably, I suppose, the famous 2011, where Johnny Sexton quoted another Liverpool comeback. And they've disappeared off the radar. Leicester, we've seen in another way, kind of drone as well, but they've managed to self-correct, and as you said, I think to get to the top twice in 5 or 6 years after having a wobble is the sign of a proper team.
Yeah, I think you're right there, and I think also you have to factor in, you know, a lot is made of the difference in the Irish system to the English system, but I think it's fair to make the point that they are playing attritional matches week in, week out in the Premiership. Their top players do have to front up at club level an awful lot of times. And so to peak for quarterfinals, semifinals and finals of Europe while still delivering and reaching the top four in the Premiership, you know, which they need to do in order to reach the postseason, is a hell of an ask of players. And yet Saracens have found a way to manage that situation. So, you know, here we are, they're going into the playoffs shortly, lying second in the Premiership, and yet they've just come off two extraordinary performances to beat Glasgow and Munster in the quarterfinals and the semi-finals of the Champions Cup. And I think if you talk to, or if you listen to, certainly the coaches of those two respective vanquished teams, they were kind of lost in admiration and slightly shell-shocked for the quality and brutality of the Saracens' performance that they came across.
And equally telling, maybe, is the game. We were talking about the Leinster conveyor belt, Alex, but yeah. I mean, they sent out their second string against Exeter's second string, but they annihilated them. So, I mean, there is a continuity here that we're not going to. This isn't just the model that we have to look on Saracens. There's more around the corner from them.
Oh, there is. I mean, yeah. Just last week, watching the Saracens shadow team, as you say, put Exeter to the sword. You could see that they've got a special young group coming through who are feeding off the success of that senior group at the moment. The likes of Farrell, Atoji, the Vunipola boys, Jamie George, George Cruz. I mean, there's a whole lot. You know, Liam Williams, my goodness, how good was he in the Six Nations Championship? You know, he's in the team and people barely mention him at times. You know, this is a pretty outstanding group of players, and they remain fired up. They remain hungry. There's something about the way Mark McCall does things at Saracens. He just knows how to push the buttons and keep that group hungry for more. You never see Owen Farrell celebrate anything. He's always looking at the next thing. Very Johnny Sexton in that way. Always looking for the next challenge, the next mountain to climb. And that rubs off on the players around him. You know, Saracens and Leicester are very similar in their mentality. They're both achieving great things, you know, which makes the game at the weekend so fascinating, because on any given day, if one of them is just kind of 2% off their peak, the other one's going to win. You know, it's that good a game.
Eddie?
Yeah, I think the broader picture of Saracens is stability around the club. I was fortunate to deal with Saracens through Chris Wiles, who was in the Eagle squad when I was coaching the US. And, you know, when you're a national coach, you're trying to track players and clubs and talk to people about availability. And it can be a nightmare, particularly if they're in France or something. But I must say, all our dealings with Saracens are incredibly professional. Everything was straightforward. You make a call, you get an answer. When is he available? When is he not available? There was great communication. Even been in there visiting Chris a couple of times, had the Eagles in there as well training one time. It's a very well-run operation. Mark McCall is a very smart guy. He's been around the game all his life. But they built this, I suppose, again, a bit like Leinster. It's basically a brand, you know, Saracens now. Before the Brendan Venter was brought, McCall came in under Venter, you know, did his time. And it's that stability, and they create...
But with none of the natural advantages that Leinster had in terms of capital city, only professional outfit that is successful, etc., etc.
Yeah, they take...
No feeder schools.
The interesting thing is they take as well, you know, an interesting approach. They are very professional, obviously. But they always as well make this atmosphere around the club as a family atmosphere. And it sounds a bit... Sounds a schmaltzy, but yeah. It's actually works very well. The guys that go to play in Saracens want to stay there. No one wants to leave. Mm. And there's a very competitive environment, so you've got to go out and deliver all the time. Plus the fact that they do things with the team, like I remember their captain got in trouble a while back for a few years ago, I can't remember what it was, for missing a launch of the Heineken Cup because the team were off in Europe at a beer festival on a Tuesday.
They seem to bond quite frequently.
What's going on with that? Or, I know they used to arrive in, if they had a free weekend, they could arrive in the US for a weekend just to Florida for getting the sun in the middle of winter.
Skiing, etc. So they have
this kind of approach that they try and get the life balance in the club between pressure, competitiveness, family, enjoyment, and they get that right. And players want to go to Saracens. So if Mark McCall picks up the phone and rings your agent, there's only one thing going to happen. The reason that teams and players do that is because they want to be there. It's just the fact they've delivered this sort of environment as guys want to be part of it. And they supply most of the English team. So it's a very good place to be if you're a professional rugby player.
Alex, how do the other clubs view Saracens? Is there a sense that they're getting away with something? I know there's an investigation to do with the salary cap and Nigel Ray's the shared companies he has with some of the players. Does that always come up in conversation when people are looking at how successful they are, or is it just on occasion people will mention it?
I think probably just on occasions, but you know, a lot of people are thinking it. You know, they see the amount of quality that Saracens are able to attract to their squad. They look at their own teams and the fact that they have spent up to the salary cap and don't seem to have half as many players of the same sort of talent, and so they, yes, they do ask the question as to how it's possible. You know, the suspicion has hung around Saracens for 2, 3, 4 years, but nothing has been proven.
Well, there's a total lack of transparency anyway, Alex, in even in the financial structures in Ireland. I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong in there, but like no province publishes chapter and verse on the detail of, you know, who pays what percentage, whether the guy gets a $5,000 a month home, is that particularly included in the contract terms or anything. So there's a typical touch of the Irish and maybe the other English clubs wanting to point at the rich boy and saying, look at him, he's spoiled, he has all the advantages, you know.
Yeah, there absolutely is. And I mean, I do think going forward that rugby is possibly going to have to follow the NFL model and start publishing salaries down the line. Just because, as you say, there isn't a transparency at the moment, and it does lead to a few insinuations and inferences, if not all-out allegations. You know, Saracens have been investigated. They claim to be completely clean. Nigel Ray sent out an open letter to answer all his critics, detailing, you know, everything he's done, as far as we can see, anyway. And it does seem to be kind of above board, but you know, the questions will remain while they continue to be successful, while they have a squad as they have at the moment and then announce that they're signing Elliot Daly to join the squad this summer. People are thinking, you know, how is that possible?
Delalio says he's getting double his money that he was at Wasps.
Yes, well, precisely. I guess you can take it you can be completely cynical about it and be bitter about it, or to a degree you can slightly enjoy the rugby and the way they go about their things. But I think if you're being balanced about it, you enjoy it, but you do also want to keep them honest, want to make sure that everyone is on a level playing field. If sport has ever been that way,
well,
you know, and that's the question.
You know, I mean, this is the kind of the double think that everybody's after, some sort of vestiges of the amateur era, but then you go and sell 32% of your league to a hedge fund. Like, I mean, so, you know, this is the world we live in. Nigel Ray has invested tens of millions. There's no doubt about it. He writes big checks. But we've seen a series of hapless sugar daddies try to do the same, maybe not to the same extent. And their money has just been pissed down the drain. At least he's getting a return for his investment.
Well, I mean, that is undoubtedly true. I mean, a number of money men have come into the sport and it has gone pear-shaped quite quickly on a number of occasions. I mean, Newcastle originally with Sir John Hall were the kind of first example of success, but even they couldn't sustain it down the line. And now, yeah, there are a number of clubs who are in heavy debt, and, you know, CVC are coming on board. They're giving a lot of money to these clubs. Premiership Rugby kind of promised that all that money was going to go into the various things around the club, improving stadium and all the rest of it. But, you know, you always sense, as I do, that most of it's going to go towards player wages and people are going to end up in even deeper trouble than they are at the moment.
Yeah, well, it enables the sugar daddy to pay himself back or herself, but they are men mostly, and then he can kind of funnel the money in a different kind of way. So there's a lot of creative accounting. Once money goes into a club, there's different ways of hiding it or dressing it up as something. But, you know, Leinster, we know that they have deep pockets because of the population, and they have structural advantages, and they have deep pockets because of the corporate sponsorship that Eddie referred to. So, I mean, it is a fascinating clash of cultures, but both exceptionally modern and both exceptionally commercially ruthless.
Yeah, I think off the field and on the field, it's an intriguing game.
Let's go on the field. As I was saying, one of your colleagues, Robert Kitson, says, you know, it's like wrestling with pythons just in a sack there, trying to pick out a winner. You, in fairness, you've made a good point that if anyone underperforms by 1 or 2%, you'd expect the other to win. But just give us your 90 seconds of how you see the match going and a prediction. Why not?
Well, I see, you know, I look at the head-to-heads. I think Leinster 3-0 in the head-to-heads. But I just feel that this season, Saracens have cranked up a notch. And I look at Leinster and I perhaps don't see them having really kicked on. Maybe I see that slightly in parallel with the fact that Ireland have slightly plateaued, or have undoubtedly plateaued in the Six Nations this season. So maybe that's kind of rubbing off on the way we're thinking about Leinster. But I do think that if Saracens take their A game to Newcastle, they are going to be very difficult to beat. The one thing I have noticed being around Saracens over the last couple of days is that there is a huge respect and regard for the coaching of Stuart Lancaster, who many of the young England players at Saracens grew up with. And I think they know that he will be able to read what they're thinking, and he's going to bring something to the party which is going to complicate matters for them. So I think they're taking that into account, but they're not assuming anything. They are talking openly about the fact that the performance which blew Munster away in the third quarter, which destroyed Glasgow with 7 tries in the quarterfinal, won't be good enough to beat Leinster. I expect them to crank it up, and I expect them to win the final, but only narrowly.
Eddie?
Yeah, I couldn't disagree with that, actually. I think the tactical battle is going to be phenomenal.
Draw it out for us. Where is it happening?
Well, they're two very similar teams in the way they play the game. They don't play high-risk rugby in their own half. They're both capable of taking you through 20 or 30 phases and punching you to, you don't know what's going on. They'll choke you out like a wrestling game. And then they both have the capacity to open you up off set pieces. Like Saracens score some cracking tries off scrums and liners, so do Leinster. So they're very well matched in that respect. My one concern for Leinster is I think that this is a bit of a mission this year for Saracens. You know, they feel that this is your year to come back and make a statement. If they both play to the peak of their ability, I could probably see Saracens nicking it by one score. But that means anything could happen, really, at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised Leinster aren't underdogs, just marginally underdogs, given the fact that, I know, it's not a home match for Saracens, but also given the fact that Leinster haven't torn up the trees this year like they have last year. Michael, how do you see it?
I'd like to be contrary, but no, I get the sense that Saracens are very much like Leinster were last year, a team on a mission, and the way that they won their quarter and semi-final last year, the way that Leinster won it, are similar to the way Saracens have won it this year. And Leinster kind of played their best rugby last year. You know the way they say, we have to improve each game. When they got to the final against Racing last year, they weren't as good as they were against Saracens or against Scarlets, and they got over the line. I can just see that Mark McCall has this team primed to take on a team like Leinster, who haven't been as good, beaten once in the pool, struggled against Ulster in the quarter-final, too loose, their heart wasn't really in the match. By Leinster's own admittance, that they felt that it didn't hurt them as much to lose. So listen, it'd be great to see Leinster win it, but I just have a feeling for Saracens.
So Leinster, their performance of the season needed on Saturday.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is fair enough. Can we all agree on that?
Yep.
Yes, I think so.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for joining us. It was good to have you on, Alex.
A great pleasure.
Lovely to speak to you, and enjoy the game. Daily Mirror Rugby Union correspondent. That's about all we have time for on the podcast this week. Hope you enjoyed it. Eddie, anything to add before we go, or anything bugging you or anything interesting you in the world of rugby before we sign off, apart from the Heineken Cup final?
Lots of things, but we haven't time.
Okay. Well, there'll be loads more to get to anyway. So that's it, Saturday for the showdown, and we'll see if Leinster can deliver their fifth star on the jersey. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Eddie. And thanks to Ruth and to John behind the glass here. Go easy.